Hello and welcome to the Emotive Pixels podcast. This is a unseasoned episode numbered episode. We're just here to talk about some games. It's a Pixel Array. Pixel Array 3, but the whole gang is here. I am this week's host, Nate, and I am joined by three wonderful people. Who are my people?
I'm Craig.
Polly Kroll.
Will Atkinson.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. I thought, even though this is a slightly different format, we would start with a question, just like always. Since it's kind of the beginning of a new year, do you have a game that's high in your backlog that you really want to get to this year? Anybody want to go first?
I want to hear yours, Nate.
Well, mine until very recently was Bioshock Infinite, and then I played 3 hours of Bioshock Infinite, and I was kind of like, eh.
But why?
I'm not sure, like, if this is something that I should push through and see. Do you guys have, can you, like, push me into leaving it in the grave or picking it back up again?
What? Why were you going to it? What made it stick out in your backlog?
Because I heard there was obviously, like, such a conversation around it when it came out. It seemed like one of those games that, like, everyone played and everyone had thoughts on, and a lot of people, it seemed like, critically, people thought it was very good. And then there was kind of that, like, a little bit of the cruft of the review that I remember of, like, longtime Bioshock heads being kind of like, Bioshock 2's DLC was better or whatever.
So here's why I would be interested in it. I heard they spent a lot of time and development energy making the person who runs around with you, like, they gave her a ton of affirmations, ton of conversation options, ton of interactivity. Really had her interact with the world, made her feel like another person that you're running around with. And so I think that is worth seeing what that actually looks like.
Okay.
Did that show up in the first 3 hours?
No.
Elizabeth? Yeah. Is she even with you?
I don't think so. It's probably slightly less than 3 hours, though. I was interested in, like, I know it has something to say about race. And as soon as it started heading in that direction, I was like, I don't really want to play, like, this person's view of race, I guess. It didn't seem very like interesting.
If you haven't met the, like, give me another word that's not titular. The very important person.
The FIP.
Protagonist?
Premier. The
premier, yeah. The Soviet premier of Bioshock Infinite.
Yeah, if you haven't met the person that the whole thing is about, around.
Yeah, it's like I got a whiff of the direction it was going, and I was like, I'm good. But I would happily take prompting to push past that.
I think there's two things. Like, one is, do you find the world interesting to try and exist in this, like, version of what Ken Levine and the team created there? So I think if the world is interesting, like, the environmental storytelling is something that, you know, I think that all of the Bioshock games were one of their primary aspects. And then secondary to that, I honestly would be curious to hear your opinion, because it felt like a lot of people came to that game and walked away being like, oh, it's incredibly clumsy and it doesn't say anything, or tries to say something and it's so clumsy that it doesn't get its point across. And it's like, is there something interesting there about, like, oh, it's actually trying to say something, it's trying to say anything, and, you know, whether the narrative beats actually hit and support that, or is it this thing where it's, like, making passing glances at topics, but not actually engaging with them? And if you get far enough in where you're like, okay, it's not even engaging with serious topics, it's just using it as a veneer to paint the city, then I walk away from it. But if it's more than that, and, like, you find out that, like, oh, behind this, like, the actual pillars that are supporting the city are, you know, these interesting devices that you can start to peel the layers apart, I think you might find something interesting there. I have no idea where it stands now, but, like, try and remember back however many years ago the game came out. That's kind of where I would head with that.
Man, I was hoping you guys would tell me that there was or was not enough there to find interesting. But you're basically saying, no, you need to go do the homework and report back.
I think I can go next because I think I could use Polly's help.
Well, before you move on, I just want to mention that I had never played that game. So report back to Nate and let me know if I should.
Damn you.
Congratulations. You got homework for Pixel Array number 6 or something.
Yep.
So I want to play a zombie game on an island that is the sequel and things happen on the island that change the way things go. And I'm not sure which of the two games that I want to play.
Oh boy.
Talking Dying Light 2 or Dead Island 2?
That's one of those two for sure.
I think Will might be more interested in Dead Island 2, honestly.
Are you more interested in combat or locomotion?
The one that I think I played first had a lot of like running around, and that stuff was really cool. But there was something about the game that was like, I make a choice and then half of the city's flooded and things are all completely wild and different. And that sounds really cool too. So parkour and flooded city, is that one of them?
That is one of
them. Or are those two of them?
Nope, that is just one of them.
Yeah, that's it's so funny. That's Dying Light 2. And yes, Will, that should be your game that you want to check out because it has co-op, but it's very far into it. And that is actually my game that I want to get to.
Interesting.
Not Dead Island 2, but Dying Light 2. I started that up and I was enjoying it, but it was a bit... There's just a whole lot of tutorial at the beginning of that game. And it was like tough for me to get through a lot of, but I really, really do want, I liked Dying Light 1 so much. We had a podcast about it and seemed like it would be a lot of fun, especially with co-op. I'd love to do that with you, Will, and everyone else here.
Yeah. I was like, Dying Light 2 is also on my backlog, but it was not going to be my pick. But if we are asking and soliciting advice to one another, then I will ask between two titles that I have that are like neck and neck on the backlog. One is The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. And the other is Cyberpunk 2077.
That was my other game I really wanted to, Cyberpunk 2077. That's actually what I was originally thinking about. But as soon as Will said that, I was like, oh, like that's clearly the winner. But Cyberpunk 2077, I started three games of it, actually. I went through all three backstories, like the intro to them, and I was really liking it. But the thing that turned me off more than anything was the really poor, other than all the other bugs and stuff like that, but the really poor car traffic. It was annoying because they like would just, they didn't know what to do, the AI of the pedestrian traffic and whatnot. So that's something I definitely want to jump into. And so much,
rebuilt.
Yeah, so much has been changed on that. It looks like they really put so much work into it. I'm excited to jump back into that one. Both those games look gorgeous, by the way. Both of them very in-depth worlds that you can really immerse yourself in, which is totally my thing.
I'm going hard on Cyberpunk for Craig.
Okay. I was like, I have like, I if I'm going to put 60 hours into one RPG, is essentially like where to go.
Cyberpunk. I don't think you'll really find the narrative or the mechanics of Tears of the Kingdom all that interesting. Unless
probably
you really want to like
the first like 10 hours.
Yeah. If you're interested in that, like the game design and the process of like coming up with your own solutions to puzzles and mechanics ways, then.
The least interesting part of gaming generally to me.
Yeah, I think you might as well skip Tears of the Kingdom.
I think there would be something in there that, as Will is dying, but I think there would be something. I would be able to admire what's been built there and be like, okay, after hearing about how much the development and like what's happening here, and it's similar to some of the other stuff that we'll probably talk about in the episode, but it's like seeing the craft and understanding a little bit through how games are made, I think I'd be like, okay, I have a lot of respect for what's happening here and like the complex things to make things simple. But I think after that would wear off, I'm hard pressed to see that I would find the fun.
Interesting fact about me. I haven't played a Zelda game since Majora's Mask.
Whoa.
And I really like those N64 ones, but nope, not a one.
Wow.
That's kind of wild.
That is really wild. Okay.
Are we covered with you, Polly, or do you?
Yeah, I mean, you guys both kind of said mine, so I'm happy I got to say a vote. The thing about me is, I probably, as you'll see with my list of games I've played, once we get into it, I probably won't play either one. I have no, like, okay. We're talking maybe 5 years down the road when I get to these games. But
I've got like five more I want to play too, so
I have the attention span of a snail.
I don't know. That's something that this is how I'll finish off, but I think the one piece that I'm interested in trying to do with my backlog this year is be better at knowing when to bounce off and not just spend umpteenth amount of hours thinking like, oh, it will turn the corner after X, or after, you know, another couple of hours, that's when it will get good.
And just now like, I'm just very like, worried about away. One of the games that you're going to be talking about.
Oh, man.
Well, I guess let's get into it. Does anyone want to go first to talk about something they've been playing that's cool or interesting? Actually, let me retract my offer. I have something interesting that just came up in gaming news that I was kind of surprised by and thought was really interesting and wanted to just put out there. On our previous Pixel Array Game of the Year episode, Craig and I talked a little bit about the Playdate. And I've since started picking up some Playdate podcasts. So Panic produced an amazing Playdate podcast with interviews of every single game that came out in season one and their creator, as well as a 2 hour long like story of how the heck they got to making a console and who they collaborated with and what the product design was like and all of that. So all of those are really cool. But
that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's really
cool. What's it called?
The Playdate podcast.
I'm all right. Curious.
Put links in the description.
Before you move on to the next one, did they talk at all about the Teenage Engineering involvement?
I haven't gotten all the way through that. It's in the episode description, as well as the product company that they used to consult that got them to Teenage Engineering. So that whole like product design is definitely a part of that podcast.
Interesting.
But I haven't listened to it yet.
Because I just watched a podcast with MKBHD, and they interviewed Teenage Engineering, like one of the design, I don't remember what his name is, but one of the product designers, and it was super interesting. That company is pretty cool.
You should post a link to that, because obviously number one fan as I hold up my Teenage Engineering phone. The other thing that I've been realizing that I didn't realize before is there's a podcast called Hello Playdate Podcast, and it's bi-weekly and they cover Playdate news. So on the front of like how well the Playdate's doing, it's doing well enough that there's like a podcast covering new releases. But something that I've been really surprised and interested in is there's like a very consistent theme of game developers porting games from very obscure hardware. And so it's becoming like a little bit of a hub of game preservation for games that are like totally way out there in the weeds that one person's really passionate about. I just thought that was really cool and something we didn't really bring up in that podcast.
I had no idea that was occurring. Is there any specific mentions, or is it like people, I would assume if you're porting games to the Playdate, it's very old games. You're talking like Atari or things of that nature.
Typically. Yeah. One this week that came up, for instance, was, God, let me remember the name. It's like Made in Wired, which is a port of an old 1990s indie game that was an indie Linux-only knockoff of the Game Boy WarioWare game that had pretty much faded into like total obscurity that someone brought back and ported the Playdate. And there's even games like that are like recent enough that there's performance issues, so that game doesn't take up the full screen of the Playdate, but apparently it still plays really interesting. So there's like... yeah, just like weird stuff going on over on Itch that seems cool.
Important question. Does the Hello Playdate podcast do the Hello Nurse phrasing of Hello Playdate?
Can you give us an example?
Hello Nurse. You know, Animaniacs.
Hello,
Hello Nurse. No. Yeah, I'll have to write them an email.
So I'm totally feeling like the Everman these days, and I feel like that's going to be my... job here. How much you want me to lean into that? Because
fully,
man, I don't remember what a play date looked like.
Oh, it's the yellow console with the crank.
It looks sort of like a blocky... Craig's holding it up, but it looks like a blocky fishing reel.
That's accurate.
That doesn't look comfortable.
It has ergonomic challenges. Is that doesn't have a backlight also?
Yeah, no backlight.
It comes with a season of games that are included in the price of it. You get a new one every week.
Looks a lot like a Game Boy, though.
It is, as I said on that episode, it's the only game or game-related object I've ever had a human woman in real life say, "Oh my God, that's so cute," about. So that says something. That genuinely happened.
No, I mean, the only one?
Yeah, what are your other contenders?
I'm more...
Give me a minute.
I'm more worried about the specification of a human in real life woman, because I don't know what Nate is developing in the background.
Lots of VTubers. Lots of VTubers, you know.
Apparently so.
Okay, that was Nate's hardware gaming segment. Who's up next? Tell me about something. Tell us about something they've played.
Insert music for Nate's hardware segment.
It's definitely chiptune.
I'll provide the update on the Microsoft thing and the next one.
Oh, good.
Yeah, there we go. Polly, why don't you tell us about one of your games?
Sure thing. Those of us who listened to the actual last real episode of Emotive Pixels, the Forza one, will be unsurprised that I've been continuing to play Automobilista 2. I have started to become addicted to trying to survive Norge life. I got a whole bunch of mods, I got a whole bunch of cars, and I'm just trying to get good and survive that track. It's funny because like I'm completely new to this whole scene and whatnot, and I didn't even know Norge life, north loop of Nürburgring.
Straight for the granddaddy, huh?
I knew that Nürburgring was a thing, but I was unaware of the history and the appeal of this track. But it's awesome, and I'm really enjoying that. I also, to kind of on the same sim racing beat, I recently got Assetto Corsa. It's been on sale and picked up for $10 for the Ultimate Edition. And the whole reason I did that, and the only thing I've done on it, is so I could get the Formula E car mod and the Mexico City Formula E track mod, so I can try out driving some Formula E cars, as I've recently been getting into Formula E. And boy, are those cars hard to drive. There is no grip. If you give it a little bit of gas, it just spins. Very fun, very hard, but I like just playing around, and I'm still playing with the controller. I don't have a sim racing wheel or anything like that, but I have so much more respect, and I'm so much more excited for the next Formula E race now, having been able to play around with that in VR a little bit and like feel the speed and how the car actually like handles and things like that. Just fooling around with a bunch of race cars and going zoom, pretty much.
So, quick question.
Yeah.
And with Automobilista, any relationship to Auto Motorista?
Good question.
I think Nate might know better than me, so I'm gonna hand this one over to Nate.
No, and I was so excited.
As soon as he said it, I thought he said Auto Motorista too, and I was like, how is there a sequel to this obscure PlayStation 2 Capcom racing game? But
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, as has been settled in the Forza episode, Polly is now the sim racing enthusiast, and me, merely the casual. He had a grand revelation that I'm not actually a sim racing enthusiast. I just like Simcade and lower.
And he actually abhors sim racing to an extent.
Well, I was about to ask you, does anyone play Assetto Corsa, or is it really just mod time?
Like, oh, yeah.
Does anyone play stock Corsa?
I don't think stock. Like, the thing, it's a 10-year-old game at this point, and the content manager for mods is actually a better main menu than the main menu in game.
That's amazing.
So a lot of sim racers play Assetto Corsa as one of the best sim racing games, but it's all modded. Like, I even got all the they're called PP, but I'm trying to think of what it's actually called, the graphics update.
Sorry, it's called PP.
Yeah, that's the initials for it, but it's a post-processing mods.
Sure, okay.
I got all those Capcom and whatnot, so it looks fucking beautiful with all that, but I didn't open up the game until I got the mods, and all I did was this one track with this one car, and it was perfect. Like, it was not so much a game as a simulator. I don't know, like, I feel like that's that's the way to go into it. If you're going into it for like a career mode or something like that, you're going to be sorely disappointed, I feel.
There's like some meme here, like what people think PC gamers are actually like, and then it's an image of Paul playing Assetto Corsa, what PC gamers are actually like, and it's my entire Discord server playing an idle game at the same time. And then there's two other panels that I haven't figured out. Anyway.
Just looking at a blue screen of death is one of them for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, what my mom thinks PC gamers are like.
And then there's got to be like... the "Are you winning, son?" thing at the bottom.
Oh, yep. There you go. What my dad thinks PC gamers are like.
I feel like as your resident everyman, you guys should tell me the name of the games you guys are going to tell us about. And then I can tell you what I know about that game. And then you can tell me how wrong I am.
Yes.
Excellent.
That sounds great. Okay.
I guess I can give a little bit of detail about it. Automobilista 2 is a small team out of South America that created a racing game. They were involved in Project Cars, I believe, and they went off to make this game.
Where in South America? Do you know?
Yeah, I'm already shocked by this news. That's cool.
It's Ryza Studios. I know that, but I'm not sure. I will find out for you.
I'm going to make a statistical guess to vamp here, just based on population. Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil.
Backup guess, Colombia.
They're currently working on their brand new site.
Okay, that's helpful. A new site of a new country?
Their website. They're currently working on their new website.
tried to throw you something there, but no.
Yeah, because Maringá, Paraná, Brazil.
Yeah. Maringá, Paraná?
Maringá, Paraná, Brazil.
That is, wow. Project Cars, CARS stands for Community Assisted Racing Simulator. It was somewhat open sourced, right? So it makes sense that they would be probably a group of contributing developers to that.
And apparently this was built on that engine, on the Madness engine, which was developed by Slightly Mad.
I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah.
But it's recently been updated a lot, and they have a bunch of cool stuff added where there's like real weather data from actual dates. So you can go to a specific date for a track and it'll be the actual live weather from that date.
Flight sim style. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's dumb. I love it.
And Assetto Corsa, you said, was what, a decade old? Something like that?
2014.
Is it still under active development, or is it it's been released and the community has taken it over?
I do not know. You're asking the wrong person for that information.
That's a great question. I don't know. They did work from a
I don't think so,
though.
Because they came out with Assetto Corsa Competizione, which is the GT racing sequel, but it's not an actual sequel to Assetto Corsa. Yeah, and I know that that one is active development because they just did an update to that.
Got it. Oh, looks like Assetto Corsa 2 is set to be released this year. So,
simultaneous console release, I wonder?
That's a great question. Although this has kind of awakened me, in addition to your guys' previous podcast on Forza, just like, there's an entire industry of racing games that does not get any sort of mainstream coverage and is all but invisible to the everyman, unless Will is like, I totally know all this shit.
Got nothing.
Yeah, it's like racing games versus The Sims for what thing is bigger and covered less.
There's like Mario Kart.
The Burnout games, some Need for Speed.
Well, wow. While we're in Paulie's racing corner, I guess I can bring up quickly, we've also been messing around with Hotshot Racing, more multiplayer fun.
Oh, from the golf company.
Yeah, is this from... Oh.
Well, wait, Craig... Okay,
I think that question came up on Forza, actually. It's properly everybody's golf company at this point. But
good old clap hands.
They're not related, right, Craig?
No, but I would absolutely love if that was the case.
Same.
But Hotshot Racing is just some arcade racing fun. It's kind of retro stylized, but it's one of those games where you just drift for boost and things like that. We've had a lot of fun playing that on the server with some people. Nate recently checked it out just the other night, I believe, Nate. A lot of fun. just a little arcade racing, way less stressful than sim racing for sure.
One thing I think is cool about that, that is weirdly different from other racing games I've played, which I've played a fair number, is that cars are like, when you want to pick your car, you pick your character first, and each character has five cars that they like own. So car choice becomes kind of like an aspect of choosing your driver, which is kind of like, oh, that's logical. Why have I never seen that before? That's how it actually works.
It kind of looks like it has like the N64 aesthetic, like that era of like Cruisin' USA and those other games that kind of released around there. I've not seen this. It's kind of like cel-shaded, blocky.
There's a little bit of like Daytona USA to the look, I feel like. Okay. But it's still
But you can see farther.
Yeah, it's still its own thing. And the tracks are fun. It kind of reminds me of a cross. If I had to like compare it to games, it would be like Daytona USA and Beetle Adventure Racing had a baby. It would be Hot Shot Racing.
Is there any Ridge Racer in it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay.
But that's enough of my all of the racing games that I've not even all the racing games I've played recently, but it's enough for now.
Hey, Will.
Yeah, what's up, man?
What you been playing?
Oh man, I got a ton, but let's start with something tiny.
Tiny folks.
Have you guys heard of this little indie game? There's like no game to it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Can I guess?
You're just like running around in circles.
It's Vampire Survivors.
That's the one.
Woohoo!
Y'all know about that, Vampire Survivors?
I've barely heard about it.
I've heard lots about it.
What are you playing it on?
So I was playing it on Steam.
Okay.
Man, there's something weird about this game because it's really, there's nothing there. It's not good. I just beat the entire thing and unlocked everything. I don't know why I did it. I can't. It's inexplicable.
Isn't it like partially an idle game of sorts?
It can be, but you got to do a lot of work to get there. The actual like progression is built out pretty well. There are tons of, so you start out with like one character who's just got a whip, and he just automatically whips, and so the only thing you can do is move around and hope that you're hitting the bad guys. And the bad guys are dumb; they just fly at you. That there's basically, I mean, there's a little bit more than that, but there's just hordes and hordes of enemies that fly at you over and over, and so it's all about like finding the right combination. One of the coolest things is there are items that merge with your weapons, and then that you get like super weapon versions, and so you're like trying to build, figure out your loadout on each run. It's very something light. I forgot.
Roguelite.
Yeah, that's the one. Roguelite, definitely, because you're leveling up things in the middle. You can. For the most part, you're just unlocking things, but then you can eventually start getting to the point where you're like upgrading your permanent abilities over time. There's a lot there, but also there's nothing there. It's a paradox of a game. It's the game's graphics are super tiny. What are you thinking, Polly?
In lieu of you not having the everyman opinion, I'm curious, who are the vampires and what are they surviving?
I don't know that I've actually found the vampire. There are coffins, and you open up a coffin, and it's like, oh, here's another vampire hunter. The vampire's in another castle, basically.
My outside impression was that Vampire Survivor, the main character was a singular vampire, and that like the collective community playing the game were the Vampire Survivors. Is that not
right?
Could
be. Okay. It's not the gifs that I got from the game. Eventually you can go and more and more maps unlock over time, and then you can unlock the ability to like do it in reverse and do it at double time and unlock endless mode and, you know, pretty much every unlock you've ever heard of in one of these games. They're all in there. Apparently I didn't do the there's a
pacifist playthrough
game.
No, is that a thing?
The what game?
Is there an Undertale mode?
No. I was just throwing things out there.
That would be the most amazing thing I'd heard about this.
Spaghetti meatball.
Binoculars.
VR mode.
Ooh. Sus. You guys know Sus?
Oh, yeah. Among Us.
Yeah, we know Sus.
There we go. The Among Us crossover. There's apparently some Among Us characters who have some additional interesting abilities that I haven't done. But yeah, there are... there's like an adventure mode, which kind of gives a story, but the story is just like you're wandering in a forest and everybody's attacking you. It's like, oh, okay. And then you're wandering in a city and everybody's attacking you. It's like, well, okay. No Naughty Dog situation, but, you know.
Question, Will.
Yeah, what's up?
Were you an original cookie clicker?
I heard about it on some podcasts. I tried it a little bit. I got the trophy that's like, why are you trying to hack our JavaScript trophy? that's about as far as I got. That's that rule.
Okay. I didn't know if, like, is Vampire Survivors like a cookie clicker?
There's, you do gotta move around.
Yeah, that is true. All right. That's fair.
So it, and like, that's Paulie's question earlier, right? Can you just
idle? Yeah, it's an idle bit.
You really do gotta move around. If you can build up to a certain point, like there's a, in general, the maps end at, I think, 30 minutes.
Okay.
Death will run in and kill you, but you can unlock endless mode so the death doesn't kill you. And eventually, if you get powerful enough, you can overpower death and kill at least one of them. There's a trophy for that, which I have. But, like, I like that, and I like games in general where the rules are part of the mechanics, and so if you get good enough at the game, you can like break the rules. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You guys remember we played Dot Hack a while back? Hacknet. That's the one. Where eventually you were doing these hacking missions, and then there was a bank, and the bank would send you money. Eventually, if you got good enough, you could hack the bank and just send yourself all the money. Like, I love when the mechanics are part of the game, and so this is one of those where, like, death can come in, and he normally comes in and kills you after 30 minutes, but you can, like, get freeze things, and so you, like, freeze him and then run the fuck away, and so then, like, there's a whole extra... There's trophies for making it 31 minutes in, and then making it 32 minutes in.
Okay.
That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of fun stuff like that.
One last question, though. Where does this game fit in your life?
Yeah, for me, I've got like games that I'm playing in areas.
Yeah,
we'll talk about another game. I play a bunch like on the train and stuff. And I play a different game when I'm, you know, in front of the TV. But this was my like PC game when I'm watching some YouTube videos or something and throw this thing up on the side for a while.
Cool. Yeah. So it's not like your full attention grabber, but it's like kind of you're like, I'm looking for something idle to do that takes some attention, but then I can also kind of do some other stuff while it's rolling.
That's exactly right. Waiting for a build to finish, you know, that kind of thing.
It's funny because that's kind of what racing is to me, but way less idle and way less, it demands more attention. But like, it's my game I go to if I don't want to like focus on a story or something like that, like be immersed in like actual like art. It's more of like a mechanics only thing.
Are you like podcasting or like listening to podcasts or things of that nature while playing racing games, Paulie? Are you doing other things or is it like you're just in the zone?
Mostly like if that's the thing, it would be Discord, like joining voice chat on Discord and talking with people while I'm racing is something I can do, where I find it very difficult in any story game to focus on the game if people are talking in the background.
Yeah, totally.
Also listen to music. Racing games are great to listen to music while they're playing.
Yes. Yes. If I wasn't so chronically behind on podcasts, I would do that a lot more. That's a really good match.
Who's up next?
I'll go. Yeah. I talked about, I think on our first Pixel Array, I talked about Road Warden. Do you know anything about this, Will?
So I'm know about Road Rash, where you ride a motorcycle and you hit people with chains. So Road Warden has got to be the sequel where you've got two chains at the same time.
Accurate, yeah. Dual wielding the chains, yes.
Oh, I thought you meant two chains the rapper.
Yeah, on the back of your motorcycle.
He's the main character. Yeah. No, Road Warden is a miserable Polish visual novel slash survival game, I guess. It's not quite just a visual. It's like a visual novel with graphics and choices. Because visual novels have choices. So it's a visual novel with graphics, but also visual novels have graphics because it's visual. It's a visual novel.
Understood.
Is there a novel?
It's a visual novel with combat? That might have been a more useful thing to hone in on. But for the most part, it's a visual novel about a... like a very dark medieval fantasy world where you're a road warden who's sent out to like a fringe part of the empire to investigate how things are doing. And this is like a world where there's lots of beasts around that, and all human settlements on the fringes are like basically about to succumb to beast infestation or overrun at any point in time. So it's a very dangerous world to be a human.
Sounds like
what
a Witcher
is
situation?
A road warden?
A bit. A road warden is someone who's like a warden of the roads, as in kind of like a roaming police officer, sort of, but in a world without police, so not like that.
Like a Witcher?
Yeah, a lot like a Witcher, yeah. Your main character's name is Geralt. You have a lot of chest hair and two women orbiting you for some reason.
Giant sword.
I don't know that much about The Witcher. Did I get that right?
Nailed it.
Sounds right to me.
Okay. Road Warden's great. It's definitely the best visual novel I've ever played. It's really, 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 really good. But there is a spinoff called Windy Meadow. And Windy Meadow is a tough thing to bring up because Road Warden is so like singular and dark and grim and kind of like muted in its color palette. It almost has like that Game Boy Color thing where there's only like three or four colors in its palette. You know, remember on the Game Boy Color, you could like D-pad when you booted to like change the color palettes. It feels like that kind of like aesthetic. Whereas Windy Meadow is super bright and colorful pixel art of like humans up close telling like stories about people in like families in one of the just like villages that you may or may not have ever gone to as the Road Warden. So
I
it's a hard
guess, but I would totally like to know more about what's the story doing in Road Warden.
You are okay. Do you want you?
We're, wait, we're I want cool spoilers. I want Will to guess first.
Yeah, perfect.
You go to a little city, and there's a shit. What do you call it? There's a barn, and somebody's got their sister locked in a barn, and they want you to exorcise their sister, but. You're like,
demons.
I have to kill her because she's a demon.
No,
and they're
just
like, no, save my sister. And so that's pretty much where, the main conflict of Road Warden.
You did great. None of the villages in Road Warden have like a complete barn. That would be like the richest, like that's the level of grim we're talking about. It'd be like a barn with no roof. Like that would be the Road Warden version of that. This game is like it's in the same universe, but it's tough because it's very like human and personal about people, whereas Road Warden was really kind of about the place. And so a lot of the Steam reviews are like, this is nothing like Road Warden, but it's great. So I kind of had like tempered reviews or tempered expectations going in. And yeah, it's really good. It has it's told in three different stories of three different characters. Oh wait, you asked about the story of Road Warden. Is the point of Road Warden is you're sent out as a merchant, like as a road warden from the city to investigate this part of the empire that's like way off the beaten path. And you I guess the like core mechanic of Road Warden is that you have a like only a fixed number of days to complete your report. So there's a bunch of quests and stuff you get that are on a timer that's ticking down, and there's quite a bit of time pressure. And it's also kind of a Disco Elysium alike in the sense that you have like two hit points and you can definitely like permadeath yourself at any point in any one of these like 30 days you have out there.
I was absolutely thinking Disco Elysium when you said the setup for the story as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, think about that. So you're sent out, and what's really the cool thing that Road Warden did to me is that you forget the framing narrative. You're just out in this world, and then your days are up, and you go back to the city, and you remember suddenly, like, oh, fuck, I'm giving a report on these people. And the more you found out about them, what's basically happening is you're giving an account of how worthy of exploitation this part of the world is. So the more you report about what you've found and make it seem like a place worth going, the more the Merchants Guild is going to go deploy capitalism there, essentially, extractive capitalism, to kind of steal what wealth the people do have. And I really was like, because they're asking you these questions, and at you give them like answers. It just has a really cool framing device. You're like giving them answers about how cool the place was, and halfway through that you realize, oh, fuck, I'm screwing these people over. And I was really moved and surprised by that ending. So spoiler alert for Road Warden. So Windy Meadow being like stories about like individual people's lives is like a different thing. It's like very different. And it turns out it's the game that the solo dev behind the project made originally first. Then Road Warden came out and was pretty successful. And then he kind of released this as a sort of bonus after the fact thing. And Windy Meadow is cool because it turns out Moral Anxiety Studio, I forget his name, like what I thought his skills were doing place. Like Road Warden is a great game of place. But this game is a story about characters. So it's like, is he really going to be able to do characters? And I think definitely so. There are three stories, one about a woman who's been offered a job in the nearby like city and who's really struggling with her like anxiety and fear of the outside world versus like the misery of actually staying in these villages. Second story is about a child whose family is attacked and murdered by raiders at age 6, and his legs are chopped off at the beginning of his story. So you're playing with him as like it's not a wheelchair, but he's moving around in like the medieval equivalent of a wheelchair, which is an interesting thing to see. And his dream is like of becoming a bard, and he's kind of asking like, should I do what's safe in my life and stay in my village where I literally can be like myself, or should I dream like be the bard that I kind of want to be? And then the third story is about a witch who's kind of one of the things this game does really well is it brings in issues that our society has while keeping them very distant. So like, there's obviously like sexism and prejudice against this woman for being a spinster and for not having a husband, but it's in a world that's different enough from our own that it doesn't feel tropey, which I feel like is really kind of cool. So you kind of have to help her choose if she should marry a rich merchant from the town, even though she doesn't feel love, because it'll provide her an ability to like make more of her like career and passions and hobbies. But she's conflicted about like, should I marry if I don't feel love? And there's lots of different voices in the game that really give like meaningful opinions on that. And I was really just very, sort of very impressed. I was only like 4 hours by kind of each of those stories and what they were able to do.
They told concurrently or sequentially?
Sequentially.
That's actually pretty cool.
So that was really neat. So that was one of my things, and I can do the other, or I can come back around after you, Greg. What do you prefer?
Well, before you go on, do you have a is your other thing a visual novel? Because I have a interesting follow up to that on one of the games I wanted to talk about.
Perfect. No, it is not. So go ahead.
I just wanted to shout out. I actually didn't play it. I witnessed some of it. Friend of the show Reno was streaming it on Discord, but Slay the Princess is a visual novel that I absolutely have to play through entirely. It's the best visual novel I've ever experienced. It's really interesting setup where you start off on a road in the woods. It's all like hand drawn.
Wait, Paul. Will, what do you think this game's about?
Oh man.
I know this is a tough one.
This sounded like a XXX romp to me.
Perfect. Yes, exactly. That's just what I was going to get into. No, you start off, it's all hand-drawn, black and white graphics for the most part. There's a little bit of blood, but you start off in a road in a forest, and a narrator is telling you that you have to slay the princess to save the world. There's a princess at the end of this road. She's in a cabin. You have to slay her. And you can do anything based off the choices you have, but there's all these branching choices and things that happen based off what you do. And as you do things, the day begins to restart, but things change based off your choices, and new voices get involved, and it starts asking a lot of questions like, who is the narrator, first off? Is it you? Is it a voice in your head? Because other voices, like the voice of the cold, comes in, and the voice of the hero. If you slay the princess, you get the voice of the hero, but he's very curious why slaying the princess didn't do what he thought it would do. And the voice of the cold is after you end up in an eternity of nothingness. There's like a very like
Elysium comparisons.
There's like a very like dark part of yourself that doesn't care about anything that comes out and things like that. So it's really intriguing. It's a small team. It's a husband and wife team that I believe they did the voice acting as well. The voice acting is great. The writing is impeccable. I think it's the best writing I've seen since Disco Elysium. And I can't wait to jump into it more, but super interesting. And I was so surprised. I was expecting like more akin to what Will had brought up there, but, it seems awesome. And I'm very excited to check it out.
And what was it called again?
Slay the Princess.
And where can we find this thing?
On Steam.
Who's up next?
Nate, I want to hear your other one.
Okay. I've also been playing Jet the Far Shore and Jet Given Time. Jet came out.
This is the sequel to the train game, but in the air.
Which train game?
You're like on a train and the whole, it's a post-apocalyptic world and you're after, and you do the train is like your whole village and you're building up a train.
Train to Busan?
This is the same, but it's in the sky.
I was thinking Train to Busan as well, even though it's clearly not a video game.
I don't know why. Train game. I know a boat game.
Is it the Frozen train thing?
What's the other Korean train? Snowpiercer.
I'll look it up while you're telling us about it.
Yeah, Snowpiercer.
But there was a game that was about video game? There was a game about like a train that was going through the cold stuff as well.
It's Choo Choo Charles. It's got to be it.
Train Simulator 2021.
Microsoft Train Simulator. My original sleep aid.
There's a whole category of post-apocalyptic train games, apparently.
Call of Duty Warzone now has a train that you can engineer.
Huh.
Oh, the deep sigh that Nate just made is
post-apocalyptic survival train game like this.
So you're thinking of like a jet-based train?
Well, I mean, it's the same idea, but it's like you're on a jet that's and you're building out your jet, and it's like over the... It's like fog down below you. You're like, there's a world down there, but I don't know what's going on.
Oh, are you like, talking about the city?
You're trying to get to the far shore, obviously.
I don't think he's talking about a real thing.
That part you got completely. So far, you're the closest you've been on any of these games.
Although it is a little like Mad Max-ish. You're like building your convoy just in the air on a jet.
Honestly, that sounds very cool.
To the far shore.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Great. So, Nate, what the hell is Jet the Far Shore and Jet Given Time?
So, Jet the Far Shore and Jet Given Time, it's free DLC campaign, were games that I think were top of my backlist of, like, these games came out, there was a lot of hype, they had a lot of, like, indie credentials, the Super Brothers, who had produced Sword and Sorcery, which was a game that I played for 15 minutes. I feel like kind of like World of Goo. I played World of Goo for 15 minutes and was like, I don't get why this is so popular, and never found the bit that was the cool part, I don't think.
What was the other game by World of Goo folks, the one I really liked, where you threw a bunch of stuff in the stove?
Cooking Mama? No. I don't know. What was that?
A World of Goo like where you throw stuff on a stove.
No, it's the same developer.
Just interrupt me. Interrupt me whenever you find.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Yeah.
They also did the Human Resources Machine, right? Am I thinking Little of the Inferno, right developer?
7 billion humans, the captain.
Little Inferno is the
Little
one.
Little Inferno.
Not World of Goo. Little Inferno is the one that I played, and I was like, it's a fire. It's a fire. What is the point?
That's the one I played that I really liked. So, sorry, go ahead.
Okay, interesting. I knew Jet the Far Shore had notable baggage attached in that I didn't hear anyone say anything nice about it that had played it, but I heard a lot of people say really cool stuff about the intro. And I was like, well, a game not being good has never stopped old Nadykins from playing it, so I'm going to try Jet the Far Shore. And Jet the Far Shore is weird. It is extremely vibesy and mythic, which immediately makes it my shit. It has mostly nonviolent, like, movement-based mechanics, which also makes it my shit. It's kind of full of Unity jank, which also makes it my shit. Yeah, Jet the Far Shore is really cool. It has a really amazing story about like a group of like almost like indigenous / Chinese coded type characters that are pursuing the Hymn Song, which is a radio transmission that one of their ancient prophets discovered, to a planet that has plant life as their planet that they come from has like experienced ecological collapse. They call going to that world going to the far shore. So, Will, you were correct. It is cool. It's the two devs that worked on it for most of its lifespan. This was like a 10-year game dev project. We're working at the Toronto-based location of the Japanese studio of Koei, who had made a F-Zero alike that I forget what Koei's F-Zero alike was, but they had remembered their time working on this like ship-based movement kind of game. And that was kind of the fundamental concept that they were kind of shooting for. And they did that pretty well. The ship is like a fussy thing to control. What's weird about this game is that like, I don't, let me see if I can describe this. The ship is weird to control. It's a little finicky. You get used to it and eventually is a cool part of the game. What is weird about the game though is that like the controls aren't reliably responsive. So like when you go up to things, the E or the F button is interact, right? And sometimes you have to press it repeatedly, other times you have to hold it, and other times you have to single tap. And never is it clear which of those it is. And even when it is clear, repeatedly going back up to it and doing the right thing doesn't engage it. So even if it's a hold command, I would have to like tap and press E repeatedly until the hold began, which just, it's like, it's a weird part of your game to be buggy.
So I've also played some of this game, and I played the intro similar to you, and played probably, I don't know, another 40 minutes to an hour past that of the gameplay. And because of that awkward movement and the interaction, I was playing on console too, and similar thing where I was like, I never quite felt like I could understand the rules of the game world. And because of that, there just wasn't enough to keep me like fighting through that. I was like, okay, well, everyone said the intro is cool, so seeing that, so just going to pass on this being my thing. I was like, it's not worth fighting through. So I'm curious, as you continue to play it, like, does it earn the intro in some weird way? Like, is the follow through throughout the rest of the game? And does the gameplay shift in any meaningful way besides just kind of hovering over land masses?
I'm excited we're here to talk about this because I have so many thoughts and feelings, and I hope that I don't go on for too long about this, but I need a therapy session on Jet because
cap you in like 4 minutes.
And yes, there are so many things. Okay. You get used to the mechanics of the ship. So the ship eventually feels good and it's fun to control. So the core gameplay, relatively solid, just has a tough thing to get started. The not being able to interact with things reliably, persistent throughout the whole game and its DLC campaign. The structure of the game is weird. So this is very story focused, right? This is a racing game or a movement game that makes a lot of use of voiceover. The voiceover is not in English, nor is it in any known language. As far as I understand, they took all the people they knew that spoke different languages, even including like indigenous Inuit languages. And they said that they like threw everything they knew about those languages together and quote, put it in a blender and they had voice actors, professional voice actors, record kind of the results that came out. So it kind of sounds Chinese-y, but there's a lot of non-Chinese things going on as well. Really cool. What that means, though, is that you have to read subtitles to get the plot, and that has a lot of criticism on Steam. And I was kind of like, that's not really a problem for me, because it's not like you're really actively doing enough that you can't look down at it. But towards the end of the game, there is like a boss fight. There are moments where you have to do things. And in those moments, the story can kind of fly you by because you obviously can't understand what they're saying. So that is kind of like a structural challenge. Like, okay, that was an interesting choice. And what's interesting about that is in the second game, given time, they kind of do away with that completely. A lot of Steam reviews say, this is really annoying. You have a co-pilot that talks the whole time and that's the game. Well, in the second campaign, you have no co-pilot for narrative reasons. You're all alone, and they back off from the first game also kind of has the problem that you're constantly on very guided missions. You're being told exactly what to do all the time, and you don't really have too much freedom. The second game is more open world, and you kind of have an open-ended quest that you need to figure out how to complete in the whole world, and you kind of get the freedom to do that.
Okay.
But my problem with that was, I wasn't really interested in the quest I needed to do. And so I ended up using the chapter select feature to kind of skip the main bulk of that campaign. So resolving that problem didn't actually resolve the problems for me. It's really interesting. It's what makes the opening cool. So just to describe this, you kind of start on this world, you've just landed, you need to go out and explore this world a little bit. It starts with you piloting the ship to the launch pad that takes the final group of humans up to the space station. And there's this, I mean, this is the opening people talk about, but you have to play like 30 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
You get to this like very grand sci-fi, like horrific polluting industrial city. You fly through it. You get to the spaceport. This rocket launches up and the camera follows it as this like just amazing sci-fi, like ambient orchestral drone piece plays that like builds in intensity as the spaceship gets closer to the mothership up in orbit. And it's so good. If you're into like the way sound is used in games or the way soundtracks are applied, that opening is just fucking terrific. 10 out of 10. It gets up to the station and the station slowly leaves Earth orbit as like you get to the station and a year counter appears and it says year zero and the space station slowly pulls away from Earth and the year counter like goes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and it starts counting up and it like flies through until it gets to 1,000 when it stops at the planet you come to. And man, it's good. But the game, like the problem with your opening being that good is like, I think the soundtrack in this game is stellar and totally a reason worth playing all of these, despite all these things I'm talking about, but it's never going to hit that high again. And the end can't quite do it either, just because it's so like epic and so perfectly done.
I really wanted to play the game, and I think you kind of touched on the main reason why I didn't. I was listening to Vinny Caravella from Giant Bomb's take on it, and he also played the game. He also enjoyed it, but his main gripe was, your mechanic is flying the ship, and although at the beginning it doesn't feel great, you do get used to it, but reading subtitles at the same time as that is not like a fun thing for him to do. Like, he would rather, he wants to experience the story, but he doesn't want to read subtitles while he's trying to do something else. And that's something that struck me as like, maybe I shouldn't play this game, because like, I don't even like walking and talking games where like, you have a headset going on, you're supposed to walk, because I have like anxiety about getting to the point before and then missing some of the dialogue and shit like that. And I definitely want to experience the story, but it doesn't seem like this game wants to hold my hand through that. So
no,
one of the main reasons I didn't pick it up.
It's frustrating because it being in another language really does add to that, the mythic nature of the story they're telling. They don't use familiar words. There's a lot of like abstraction, and that really is part of that's like the main draw of this game's like aesthetic. It's not a particularly novel sci-fi story, but the confidence and vision with which it's told is really good. So it's really conflicting. It's very strange. I couldn't tell you how I feel about it, other than its vibes were really good.
Nate, did you listen to the Eggplant podcast about with the developers as well? Did that give you a better understanding and appreciation for the game, or like where did that leave you kind of with after? Because I think you listened to it after you played through the game as well.
Yeah, my favorite thing is that first of all, this is so Eggplant is a podcast where game developers interview game developers. They talk about how they make games. This is one of those ones where the creators are obviously like two mega introverts, and they're able to like, this is my impression. I don't know if this is true, but there's been a couple games like this where they're like, how did you guys communicate on exactly the kind of game you wanted to make? Like, how did you get the impression aligned between you? And they're like, oh, I don't know. We just kind of both wanted to make a game just like this. It's like, wait, you're telling me a game like this just kind of came out of like shared assumptions, not like, but the best part was that intro that everyone talks about. They realized to create the way they described it was, well, we realized to create the kind of mythic science fiction mood we wanted, we needed a good intro. Because they had the vehicular part like down, but they were like, we need a good intro. And so, because the question to them was like, was the intro first and the rest of the game later? And they were like, no, absolutely not. We like just sat down and knew we needed to make an epic intro. And that was what came out. It's like, okay.
I mean, it seems clear when you're describing what follows on that it was done in inverse, right? In some capacity that if the intro was done first and that was the mood piece that set everything up, you would think there would be a higher influence of that.
I guess
that
that's
would
very
follow
true.
On, yeah. Right? And instead, yeah. It's, when you've described it, like there seems to be some sort of disconnect, at least between how that's carried through the next few hours of gameplay versus where it exists in the start.
That's very true. That's a cool thing you pointed out. I thought of the intro as like almost like a cutscene. Like sometimes cutscenes exist to do things that the game itself can't, but you're
sure.
Supposed to like, yeah. But yeah, that's a very good point.
Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I would. I actually only recommend the first campaign because the first campaign ends in a very interesting way that leaves you hanging, and that's kind of, I feel like, appropriate. And then the second campaign tries to offer resolution. Yeah, exactly.
When you say the first campaign, is that like a mission or the not DLC or whatever that you're talking
about? The not, just Jet the Far Shore, not Given Time.
Got it.
Yeah. Whew, thank you for letting me express all that. I came away very impressed, but not sure if it was good.
Seeing as this is probably the only time you'll be able to podcast about the game because we ain't all playing it, sounds like. What's the rating?
Oh, God.
Put him on the spot.
How did we end up doing Forza? We said, like, as a game, it was like 6 out of 10, but as an experience that we enjoyed, it was a so-and-so out of so-and-so.
So you guys did some shit like that, yeah.
I was like, I ain't owning that. I feel like for me, the experience of it was really cool. Like a 9 out of 10 with really that one being knocked off mainly for like the controls being so bad that I was like gaslighting myself that I might not be pressing the E key or something.
Yeah.
But man, it's a game. It's gotta be like a 7.5.
Craig, what game can you stump me with?
Foam Stars.
Foam Stars?
Foam Stars.
Oh, well, this is obviously the sequel to Nintendo's Squid Ink game.
Wow!
Wow, he got it. He actually got it.
Am I right?
The Splatoon sequel. This absolutely is a Splatoon alike.
But it's not from them. It's from Ubisoft.
No, it's not from Ubisoft either.
Oh, Square Enix?
Yeah. Which is truly wild. So, Will, you absolutely crushed it, whether intentionally or not. Foam Stars is a Splatoon-like game, which case you are... It's essentially a third-person shooter, but violence is not the name of the game. So, like, you're in an arena, and you're spraying foam all over the place. And when the foam lands on the ground, you can, like, slide on it to use it for movement. And you're also covering your enemies in foam. And when they get fully covered in foam, they turn into like a big foam ball. and then you slide into them with like your surfboard and you slide kick them.
Katamari Damacy?
Yeah, it's Katamari Damacy. You slide kick them and you chill them. It's not kill, but you chill them. So, because as the intro calls out, Foam Stars is all about keeping it courteous. So, yeah. And while the, if you get foamed up, then one of your teammates can also slide into you and save you. So they can kind of like prevent you from getting knocked out.
Can I ask what the rating of this game is? Because it sounds like they're pulling long shifts to get everyone rating on this thing.
Oh, it's definitely a rated E for everyone.
Nothing suggestive about all this foam?
No, I don't think anything's...
wow.
Covering their faces with it?
That's impressive.
They go to extreme kind of lengths to make sure that this is very family friendly, and the enemies you're facing are these little cartoon characters essentially that are called bubble beasties. And you so let me back up. This game developed by Square Enix and multi-platform, so definitely trying to reach a large audience, and was free on PlayStation Plus this month, which is why I decided, I was like, all right, I'll hop in, let's check this out. I never really got into Splatoon. Zero barrier of entry here, like I'll give it a go. It's very Japanese. Like,
how Japanese is it?
I would describe, besides all of the other pieces here, like, I don't know if you guys played old school Dynasty Warriors games and things of that nature, where
99 just, nights, baby.
Yeah. You just, do you remember like these tutorials where it just like pops up like a big old text box and it's like, press X to jump and like hit X, and then you like walk forward and it just like hard stops you, hard stops your animation, and it's like, look to your left, look to your right, and it's just like that sort of animation style with these like big text boxes that just pop up, and it's like very direct. There's no like, just go and explore and like try some stuff out and we'll kind of give it to you. It's just like, we are putting you on literally a path between walls and we'll tell you exactly how to play the game.
Did y'all know, sidetrack, sorry, did y'all know about the Halo where in the Halo intro, they tell you to look up and look down, and that's where they decide whether or not your stick is inverted.
Yeah. Genius.
Which is a great way to do that.
I don't know why. Yeah, no one has ever done that since.
It's still amazing. Like, what was it recently? Teardown came to consoles, and they didn't have an inverted option. And so some people were like, I just straight up can't play this until they patch it, and they're like, we're going to add it. And I was like, how? Anyways.
Before you continue with Foam Stars, you said you didn't really get into Splatoon. Have you played any Splatoon?
Zero Splatoon.
Okay.
Maybe I've played at like a demo station or something of that nature, or maybe a demo that popped up on the eShop.
Is that, well, maybe I'm jumping ahead of the gun here.
I have very little much to say about this.
Okay.
But as you're going through, it is a bit of like a hero shooter in that you have like six different characters that all have different kind of specials and different kind of like primary attacks that can charge up over time. And one of them has like a shotgun foam blaster and a sniper foam blaster and a rifle foam blaster and things of that nature. There is both like a single player kind of arena, like wave-based combat to get you familiar with the enemies, and I was still surprised that there's like a 6-minute cutscene that plays before you start off, like setting the stage that you're going to the bubble ski suburb because of foam, and it's attacked by bubble beasties, and you're in Bath, Vegas, and and you're trying to prevent them from like destroying this core, and the bubble beasties are just like, they almost look like rubber duckies and things of that nature coming at you, like little, like almost pool toys or bath toys for children. It's just
great.
Yeah. It's like kind of amazing. And then the other piece is a multiplayer arena shooter, which is like what the primary focus of this is trying to be, is a 5v5 shooter with a bunch of different game modes to knock people out. So that's kind of the sell of it.
Having played some Splatoon, I'm very curious about like the vibe of this game, because Splatoon has a whole vibe going on and it sounds like they're going for it, but I don't know if they, it seems, also seems different somehow. And it's hard to ask you because you didn't play Splatoon.
Yeah.
But
well, what do you mean by whole vibe? Do you like, mean like total aesthetic package?
Well, a lot of the game is like the surroundings of the game. Like the main menu is just a hub that you walk around in, and like fashion is a big part of it. So you like got to buy clothes and like look good. And like, there's like a TV connection. Show. With the Squid Sisters, Callie and Marie, and they have jokes and they have like contests, and like they'll be like, oh, this week it's ketchup versus mayo, so the colors are going to be white and red, but then like everybody chats into whatever Nintendo's chat feature is, I can't remember what it's called, but like everybody's just constantly fighting about if mayo or ketchup are better condiments and things like that
sounds so great.
It is pretty good. It's actually really like compelling way to like keep you interested in the game by creating this kind of community around it. So it's kind of sounds like they're going for the in a way on that, but also different. So that's why I'm curious.
It's a little bit like that, in that you do have like this kind of hub space that you like move through like a shop. And I was playing on a Friday night and there was like a DJ party started for Frye, and I was apparently too early in the night for it, and it wasn't going to start until 8 o'clock.
So and then I was like, they are just doing it. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, they're fully going after it.
That's only on Nintendo, so there's definitely a market out there for it.
It brought like a smile to my face. Like I was playing this, and I was like, this is like silly and kind of hilarious, but also I kind of brought up Dynasty Warriors previously because those games all felt fun to play and you're like just like smashing into things, and this has a little bit of that where it's missing that Nintendo polish, so like everything feels good but not great, and like the foam and things of that nature, like there's like a little bit of like start stop, like it just doesn't have that fluidity that you would kind of expect from something like this. And that was something that I think that Splatoon seems to have captured both visually, but also mechanically, where it's like, you're like sliding around and you're moving through the space. And all of this felt just like, there's just a little bit of friction there still. And I'm kind of curious if that gets ironed out, but also on a Friday night playing this, like 2 weeks after it came out on Plus, the matchmaking was like 40 seconds long to get into a match, which I was like, this is probably not a great indicator of how many people are playing Foam Stars tonight.
So the one thing I know about Splatoon is they had a weird motion control control vibe to
it. Yeah, gyroscopic controls.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Shit was awesome.
Anything like that going on here?
No, nothing here. It's like very much a traditional like third-person shooter. I did get MVP in my second match, so I was stoked on that.
Bots.
And then I was like, no, these were against real humans. Thank you very much. just poning the noobs. And then I was like, I guess I'm done. I was like, I'm leaving this on top.
I do wonder why I compete with Nintendo on such Nintendo grounds. I know, obviously, there is a bigger market, maybe.
More money to be made. I mean, Splatoon is Nintendo only, right? I mean,
Splatoon.
That's going against Nintendo on home turf, I guess, I feel.
It really is a direct competitor, so it'll be interesting to see if it gains any traction over time, but I think it's well covered across other industry podcasts of how many multiplayer things exist these days that are competing for time.
What if Square Enix used their Disney connection to get Disney people into the game? Then would it get there?
Mm-hmm. I could absolutely see
instant
that.
Instant billions.
Sephiroth.
right?
Yeah, exactly. Wait, hold on. Is it a Splatoon-alike in the sense that you're competing for coverage, or is it a shooter?
So the mission that I played, or like the game mode I played, was one where you were not trying to get coverage of the ground, but instead you were eliminating enemies, and then someone became like the like crown wearer, and they could do more damage and stuff, and each team was competing to protect and defend each other's enemies. There was a bunch of other game modes, and I think one of them is one of the more like area of control, but that was...
Oh, I heard about the area of control. That's Alan Wake 2, right?
Are you going to play that, Will?
I've never played an Alan Wake.
Well, you can start with 2. 2 is the one to play. Yep.
Yep, absolutely.
1 is sort of inside 2, so you'll got it covered.
Yeah. Yeah, that... Yeah. Or, yeah, yeah. Yep. No need to play the second or first.
All right. So I would like to tell you guys about another little game I played called Persona 5.
Oh, my God. Little. Yes, little indeed. I've heard it's a... I'll be the everyman. The one thing I know about Persona. So, tiny game.
Yeah, itty-bitty game. Quick, small, digestible experience. We've actually done a whole episode on Persona 5, so I won't get too deep into it, but I would love to hear any questions you guys have for me.
How is Persona 5 different from Psychonauts 2?
All right, let me get started.
In the sense of, it's about like going inside the psyche of people who have, you know, problems with their ego, right? Like, essentially?
So Persona's less metaphysical. Persona's way more about building relationships with people. There are benefits you gain from building those relationships, but it really is about, like, here's this person going through this thing in their life, and how can I be involved? How can I be there for them? How can we help them solve their problems? How can we get them to a different area, a different understanding, different level of their relationship? And there's a ton of different characters. Like, one of the first love interests is she's like trying to be a model, but she's a half American person living in Japan, and so she's got certain like expectations, and she's like she has been a model based solely on her like native skill, and she's starting to get to a point in her career where the people around her are like actually putting work into it, and so this is not something that she's ever done before. And so you're like, do you encourage her to kind of go down that path and compete against people who are like being nasty bitches? Like, how do you deal with that kind of thing?
Doesn't that sound like a mission in Psychonauts 2?
Like, if you were in their head and like changing the way they felt about and their understanding of the world, but it's more like, I mean, instead of inceptioning them, you're like working with them like you're a psychologist, and less like you're inside their head.
Oh, I thought the boss battles were literally going inside the villain's head to like rewire how they're thinking or something.
No, not in this game. Okay. Well, oh, sorry. Hold on. Sorry. Yeah.
Wait for it.
You are also right. That's how.
Okay.
Sorry. I was thinking about how like the social links work out your peers, basically. And mm-hmm. So you're building up all these things. But yeah, yes, the fighting the boss battles does kind of work exactly like that, now that I'm thinking about it.
I just asked that because
it feels very...
Every time I hear people talk about it, I'm like, how is nobody even tangentially bringing up Psychonauts 2?
Yeah, it feels so different. But now that you mention it, it feels so the same.
So, question for you, Will.
Interesting.
Have you played Persona 5? And because Persona 5 originally came out, what, 2016? And Persona 5 Royal came out last year?
That's correct.
Okay. And is Royal a remaster?
This very podcast did a
Oh, right. Podcast that, yeah, this is
on
true.
Persona
yeah.
5.
Yeah. Touche.
You can go back and listen to this podcast.
I will go back and listen to our episode. God,
but assuming you're
that?
Not going
to
do that. I think it was me and Brian and Esteban.
Okay. This makes sense. So what made you want to go back and replay it with the content from Royal?
One of my things I said about the end of that game is that I feel a weird sense of, I think we figured out there's a word for it, but I always feel like a weird sense of nostalgia. It's not nostalgia because it's something like I wish I was a part of, but it's like, man, I wish I was a kid who grew up in this kind of environment. And so I have this it's like a comfort food kind of situation, but it's like, man, I always wish that I had this kind of, and you know, you kind of all go like, oh, well, the next time I grow up, I'll grow up in Japan. It's like, well, you know, you only get one life and that's not never going to happen. Right. It's kind Maybe. Of like a, it's a weird sense of funny nostalgia. And so, when I saw it pop up again, I was like, oh, you know, I really enjoyed it last time. I did not get the platinum trophy. So there are definitely things I missed last time, and it seems easier this time, maybe. One of the things I regret on this playthrough, and now that I'm like 70% through my playthrough of Royal, I'm less sure whether or not I regret it, but when you buy the DLC, they give you a persona that is like I think it's like level 80. And in the beginning of the game, you're like, you have characters that are like level 7. And so they give you this super overpowered persona that just destroys people and breaks a bunch of the systems in the game. Some of the dungeon progression is supposed to be based on how much SP or basically mana you have. And this DLC character gives you the ability to instantly regenerate it, which is something you just shouldn't have that early in the game, if at all. And so it feels like it really broke the game part of it, by which I mean the combat part of the game feels like it was broken by having that DLC character. But also there's a ton of like the visual novel story bits that happen as part of the game. It's like way easier to get to, and I have less to worry about. And so those things are just kind of simpler in general. So like in feel 70% into the game, I feel way better about it. But yeah, it's interesting.
How different is it from the original?
It is very similar. So there's one character that I don't really remember being in the game. And she's still kind of only like half in the game at all. Okay. And so I'm like, how did she like just get tossed in at the end? And then there is so one of the biggest complaints about Persona 5 is that the big bad shows up like halfway through the last mission of the game. And you're like, who the fuck is this guy? And what is he doing? And why are we, what's going on here? And they kind of introduce him a bit better in this game. He's, if it is who I think it is, he's like introduced as a vendor in the game. And so at least he's aware around and you know that he exists. But still, it's like, what the
heck
is he
doing there? Not really solving
the
problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Which is even more wild because these games are, historically 100-ish hour playthroughs?
Yeah, I think I just hit like 80 or 90 hours on my current playthrough.
Okay.
It's tough in general, but even more tough on these games. Like, if you've been playing it for so long, you just leave it paused overnight, and then come back, and you're 20 more hours into the game. literally, the last on my playthrough for the podcast, it was pegged at 999 hours, 99 minutes. So it was like, or 999 hours, 59 minutes. Like,
nice.
Okay, well, that's not a real thing, but
I have to interject. if we recorded a Persona 5, it never was. That was one of the lost episodes. We recorded a Persona 4, though.
Did you also record Golden?
Yeah. This is a lost episode.
It could be.
I was like, I remember Persona 4 Golden, but yeah. How are you playing through Persona 5 Royal?
This is on my PS5.
Okay.
So wait, that DLC shit you're talking about is in the Royal? Persona 5? That's buck wild.
Yeah. I'm assuming it came with one of the DLCs for the original Persona game. And it's like end game content that you can buy and have in the very beginning of the game.
It kind of makes sense if you wanted to just play through it again quickly, though, no?
Like, I guess that's true.
Is it an option? Do you have to use it? Or does Will have to use it because he has it?
I've been trying not to use... Part of the Persona game is the Pokemon aspect of it, where you're going and you're collecting all the different personas, and then you breed the personas, and then they have different, each have abilities, and then you breed them, and then you have some new persona that has some of the abilities from its parents, and then there's like a whole breeding structure, and then there's like 300 different personas, and you're trying to get them all. And so, like, I've been trying to go through that whole system, and if you just play with the DLC character, he'll just demolish everything, and you won't level up all the other personas, and so I've been going out of my way not to use him, except for when I use him to reset my mana, basically.
And this is also historically a thing that happens with Persona games, right? Like Persona 4, and then there's Persona 4 Golden, 5 Royal. Have you played, like, is that something for you? Do you look forward to that, like Persona 6? Are you like looking forward to like, cool, I get to play it, but then I get to come back to it so many years later with some additional things fleshed out and things of that nature?
So there's been a reason for those. So it's basically the remake versions of everyone. So it's not I'm exactly going back to the well.
Yeah.
But like Persona 4 was a PS2 game, and Persona 4 Golden was a Vita game. And so if you want to play on the Vita, like that was the version. Royale is the PS5 version of the game. So it's a little bit nicer, a little bit better. There's a...
What about a Persona 3 Reload? Are you loading that one up next? Or
it's already on the PS5, ready to go.
Okay.
But I was going to say, Persona 3 had the... they added a whole second character in the PSP version of the game.
But not in the new one.
Yeah. Oh, the second character. Oh, really?
Yeah, you're talking about the femme protag?
Yeah.
Not in this one. Pretty wild.
Huh.
No, really?
And that's the thing. Persona giveth, Persona taketh.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, wow. there was considerable debate on Into the Aether, I think last week, about like, it's impossible to say which Persona 3 is the best one to play, which you'd think that these remasters would always be the
definitive.
Best.
Right. Yeah. Huh.
So I've played 1 and 2 on the Vita, the PSP versions of them. I played through about half of 3, so I'm thinking I'll probably go back and play. I mean, I've already got it down on the PS5.
It just came out, right? Like a couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
Or early February 2024, when we're recording.
But there's another PS5 game that might hit. Well, there's one for the podcast.
Is it a certain
there's another
unspecified level of fantasy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That will also be for the podcast.
It's going to
be
you.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Okay. But also, I've never played a Shin Megami Tensei game. So, there's a whole field of games out there that I still have.
I feel like, in my heart of hearts, I feel like Shin Megami Tensei is more the Will game series.
It could be.
Yeah, interesting.
Persona's I still don't remember why I initially played Persona 4. But I did not expect what I got out of Persona 4. Like, when I started playing Persona 4, I thought it was like a dungeon crawly game.
Yeah.
And so 80% of a Persona game is the social links. building relationships, like going around the world, living your life as a kid in Japan. Like that is way more of the game than actually going into a dungeon and battling. And like just seeing how deep that part of the game kept going and going and going, just blew my mind when I first started playing Persona, and I just really loved it.
Do you mean like how rich the characters are, or how rich the mechanics of exploring the character are, or both?
It felt like it was a cutscene, and then the cutscene had questions, and then the cutscene turned into a whole fucking visual novel, and you're like, oh, yeah.
Cool.
Are the Persona games related to Shin Megami Tensei?
Yeah, it's a spinoff. Shin Megami Tensei 3 or 4. I think the first one was Shin Megami Tensei / Persona.
Oh,
I think that was like
okay.
3 or 4, or like the 3.5 story or something like that.
Got it. Okay.
It's very much a Call of Duty modern warfare.
It's just like
two,
if you've
two
never played if you've never played Persona, it's just like Modern Warfare 2. It's like pretty much the same game.
Right.
No, 4-2.
Whenever you upgrade your persona, you get the din 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 din.
Are the games, do they play like almost identically? Because I know, I think Shin Megami Tensei, 5 came out sometime in the last few years at least.
No, they're very different, aren't they? Isn't one turn-based and the other, oh God, I don't want to.
Don't fuck this up, Nate.
Yeah, I think I already did.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Tensei versus Persona?
Yeah, that game you never played, Will. Tell us all about it.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about this game I never played. I don't know the details. I've seen a little bit about
typically them. Not high schoolers, they're adults. Persona's way more linear. I think they're pretty darn different.
Okay.
SMT's tends
more
to be
dungeony.
Like the deeper, darker, but Persona itself gets fucking deep and dark.
Yeah.
Like Persona 3's big controversy,
yeah.
If you guys will remember, is that so each Persona game has a method of like summoning their personas, and in Persona 3 they had the what's it called? I think it's the Devil Summoners. But basically, there's an object that looks like a gun, and in order to summon your persona, you have to point it at your head and pull the trigger. I'm seeing 4 nods all around.
Yep. Okay.
I'm like, oh yeah,
yeah, all right.
That's a bunch of kids pointing guns at their heads.
I mean,
yeah,
the best summoning of all the games.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Remington.
Yeah.
Remington.
They're leaving your state. All right, anyways. Polly, I need a past update from you on DJ Life.
That's what I'm getting to. I was all queued up.
Desperate to put that to tape.
I was desperately searching for a segue, but we'll quell that. So
yeah, well,
speaking of social links,
there you go. I've been getting into human sausage lately. Speaking of social links, Polly, what you been playing?
Oh, I thought you were gonna like expound on that. I thought you were gonna expound on that segue, Nate, but you just kind of went ahead with Polly. You talk now. Good, great job. Something that I believe has probably come up on a couple episodes, but I don't know how much we've talked about it because I've been messing around with it for quite a while now. Is getting into DJing through video games. So the game I want to talk about specifically is Vinyl Reality. And the first question I have, Will, is what is Vinyl Reality about?
Well, obviously it's the sequel to DJ Hero. You teed me right up on it. I got you. No problem.
Duh.
So I got into Vinyl Reality some time ago because I was looking for a music visualizer. I wanted to listen to some music and I was looking for a visualizer and I was like, hey, I got a VR headset. There's probably some visualizers. And there sort of is. I got a few of them. But somehow in my search, I came across Vinyl Reality, a game that I already had in my wish list and I wanted to check out. But when I first looked up it, I thought it was like player records in VR. And I was like, that's a weird thing to do. But I did it, and I'm very happy I did. Violent Reality is not so much a game as a simulator. It has a very sparse tutorial where it's like, hey, DJing exists, and the primary thing that DJs do is beat matching. Here's two sample records that you could try to beat match. Go ahead. And that's sort of it. But it feels and looks so great, and it's so authentic to the act of DJing. Like, there's one developer, and he's very dedicated to, I want this game to be vinyl DJing. I'm not going to include any of the progress that DJing as a culture, I guess, has made with technology over the past 40 years, I guess. He's like, no, you have two turntables, a mixer, no microphone, so whoever's going to make the joke, and...
I was going... you cut me off at the legs there.
And that's it. But it got me into DJing so hard that I now have a actual DJ mixer. I have two sets planned that I'm going to be releasing soon. I already put out a Halloween DJ set in...
It's good.
...in Violent Reality.
Are you using those vinyls that you have?
No, not for DJing yet. That's a lot of money to turn vinyl DJ. I do have a pretty large vinyl collection, around, I don't know, 150 vinyl records.
Would you use those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to get some vinyl DJ gear. That would be so much more enjoyable.
This is blowing my mind. I thought it was like totally like I'll buy it so I can put it on my wall kind of situation for you.
Oh, no. I play the hell out of my records, and I'm not very concerned about their, what's the word, pristine fact? It's not like I'm going to sell them or something.
Open the blister pack kind of guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I originally got vinyls because I appreciated the artwork, and I'm an album listening guy, and I really liked being able to sit down and listen to an album while I'm looking at the artwork in large format and things like that. But this kind of fed into that, because Violent Reality, no DJ. When I started playing this, I didn't know anything about beat matching or anything like that, but it was an excellent way to experience albums, because you could, first off, you can't play an entire album, but it's like active listening, because I have to play each song from the album on its own vinyl record. So I'm like making sure to pay attention to when the song is going to be over and cue up the next one, get it ready to go while there's cool visuals and everything like that going on. And this led into me also getting the other.
Hold up. What are the visuals?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of different environments. Some of them are mods, but included in the game, there's a bunch of different environments you can go to. Some of them are just a room.
Is it like Beat Saber environments? A bunch of flashy neon lights running at you?
Sure. Like, there's somewhere it's like a studio you're in, and it's there's very basic ones where it's just a room and there's two lights. But then there's also one where there's like streaming music video that's reactive to the music around you. There's some where you're in like on a stage and there's a crowd that dances to the BPM of your music. There's
Can I multiplayer this?
Some that has like lasers that shoot at you while you do stuff and whatnot.
Can I sit in VR while you do this for me?
That's what I want to.
Can you be an audience?
I can't do it in VR. I have streamed it video, but I think if you tie it in with VR chat, you could do something like that.
Ooh,
so I think there's some ways to do that, but I don't know how, because I don't know anything about VR chat.
That really does feel like the next piece, though, right? It's like, if you're doing all this awesome DJ shit, like, have other friends join in.
Well,
for me, the next piece was getting the real fucking DJ controller and turning it into a real life thing. Because
you can watch Poly DJ. It's on YouTube. It's great.
I got so into it. It's like, as a guy that's very much into music, like, it gave me a whole new way to listen to music. And I'm not trying to like go play weddings or anything like that as a DJ. It's more just a really fun, active music listening experience for me. But I also have like themed playlists that I want to share with people and things like that. So there's the whole like music selection part of it. But
was that a Barry Topping joke?
I don't
about the wedding gigs.
I don't think so.
Oh, the Paradise Killer soundtrack guy was a wedding DJ prior to...
Oh, no. There's tons of wedding DJs and things. Like, yeah, you could make money as a DJ, but this is not, like, really what I'm trying to do. But there is another VR DJ game out there called Tribe XR. And I will say, if you want to get into DJing, it's a much better tutorial, because Violent Reality doesn't give you shit. It's just like, here are the tools, fucking learn them. There's like, you can go on like websites and read people that said like, hey, this is a great way to mix things and things like that, but it's not included in the game. Tribe XR actually has an actual DJ that pops in next to you and starts pointing at controls. He's like, all right, try this. And then it comes up with like a Guitar Hero style like track, and it's like, play it with the music, and it's like timed and everything like that. So they show you how to do it. One of the best tutorials I've ever seen in a game was in Tribe XR, but I'm still partial to Vinyl Reality because it feels so much more authentic and so much less video gamey. It just seems like, hey, if you want the closest thing to actually having two turntables in front of you in VR, then Vinyl Reality is the way to go. So that's what I've enjoyed doing. And I'm super into it. I still like just getting a new album, and instead of listening to it in any way that I would, popping into Vinyl Reality and playing through it on that while there's like cool visuals around me and like just like really focused on the music. It's a great way to do that.
So are you like cross-fading the tracks in the album when you're listening to a new album?
Well, if it's a new album, I don't really have to crossfade. I just wait. I can see where the end of a track is on the vinyl. And not necessarily cross-faded in, just at the end, just cut into the next one.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
What kind of beats are we talking here?
Yeah, suddenly Polly's music listening got a lot closer to mine.
Well, I think primarily as far as electronic music goes, I lean closer to the synthwave genres, but I like a lot of different things. I have the two set lists I'm working on. One of them is very synthwave. It's called, by the way, my DJ name is Polly Malware. So it's Polly Malware's The Takeoff. And the second one is Intensive Hope, which is more of a chill, chill house. I don't really know what. There's some bicep in there. There's some cubic color. There's some more.
Sorry. I guess I was
intelligent
asking,
dance music type shit.
Do the songs come with the game, or are you bringing your own shit?
No, bringing your own shit. I actually bought way more music than I have bought electronically for this, but there's also ways around that. So,
yeah, you're not like just hooked into Spotify. You're like buying shit off Bandcamp and putting it in.
Violent Reality, the best way is if you have the Pioneer DJ app called Recordbox. That's the best way, because you can take any of your playlists and they port directly into it. It's really great electronic music, like digital music management. That's the best way to do it. But different DJing does have links to... I'm like very aware of DJ technology now. I'm like... All up on YouTube videos and things like that. Like, I happen to know that DJ algorithm just tied in with Apple Music. So now people who use that platform can use Apple Music streaming. And some of them have Spotify tie-ins and things like that. But mostly I've gone to Bandcamp and tried to get more involved with the artists that I like, purchase their vinyl albums, and then you get the digital files that go along with that.
Yeah. Okay. So Nate kind of threw it out there early on, but you're actually doing DJing in real life now. So like, are your lessons learned here like truly one-to-one, in that what you've learned within the simulation like translates directly, or does it feel very different when you have like physical touch?
Absolutely. I've learned so much from VR. That's like the actual feel of it in Violent Reality is better than anything. Like, it's just as real as putting on a record over here and things like that. And the scratching feels very, without actual being able to touch something, you know, like there's always that,
right.
That level in there. But like I said, Tribe XR, if you want to learn how to DJ, that is absolutely the best way. Unfortunately, it's a subscription that game, so it can get pricey and things like that. But it,
like, in a monthly subscription, now I'm,
I would never curious. Have gotten to be able to do what I do now without these video games, for sure. It's
that's awesome.
The most I've ever learned from a video game by far.
For the Tribe XR, the subscription there that you mentioned, like, what are you paying for by having a monthly subscription with them?
The free version, all you can do is use the most basic of units, DJ gear, I guess you'd put it, turntables, you could say, but it's not vinyl in Tribe XR. It's the, like, actual, like, electronic DJ turntables. So you get less features and you don't get all the tutorials that you would get for the paid version. Like, there's actual, like, live DJs that give lessons and things like that. Like, it's something that's hard to explain on a podcast, but, like, when you're in VR and there's a DJ standing next to you and he's like, "Hey, look at this." And, like, you look at it where he's pointing and then he's like, "I'm going to show you something," and he does it. It's, like, very easy. It's much easier to learn than any, like, standard, like, YouTube tutorial or anything like that, because you feel like you're right there next to them showing you how to do it. And then they can also overlay things like beat grids and things like that, which makes it much easier as well.
Yeah, now I'm just curious about,
but, like, also with the subscription, I think the main reason they went over to a subscription instead of what they used to do, where you could buy a lifetime license, is they have a deal with Pioneer DJ, so they can have actual real recreated DJ units in the game. So you'd be like, "Hey, if you're interested in buying this, you could try it out in VR first," kind of thing.
Yes. That's what I was going to ask.
Which is really cool.
So you had you practiced on the set you bought before buying it?
It wasn't in there yet, which is why I had to buy it.
Nice.
Nice.
But I will say there's much more you can do with the real life. I kind of stopped with, eventually in Tribe XR, you should be able to do all the things I'm able to do with this unit. But I still prefer Vinyl Reality. It just feels better to me for some reason. It's hard to put my finger on. It feels more authentic and less video gamey.
You prefer the Vinyl Reality to the real reality.
So if I'm going to jump into VR, I'm going to do that. But I prefer doing it in real life now that I have bought stuff, I guess, is the answer to that one.
It does. I am interested, just kind of as you're talking about, like, transferring this into real life knowledge and learning, when you're interacting with this from a VR perspective, do you see that, like, this is, like, a great way to learn things in the future, just in general? Like, yeah. Is there other things that you would want to learn that you think would be better done here versus?
Absolutely. I'm a trainer in real life for work. I train people on computer software and things like that. And recently I was in a lot of meetings about things like AI in training and VR and XR in training. And I brought this up as an example. Absolutely. About how, like, this is absolutely the best tutoring tool, training tool I've ever experienced, where having a real life person, not really in real life, but having somebody next to you showing you how to do things is so helpful for learning. Like, the only big jump to that I feel like is coming very soon is being able to ask them questions and having AI answer it. Because what I experienced, I didn't do any of the real, they do have lessons where an actual DJ will be in there talking to you and things like that, which would be very good, but I would be way too nervous to do that. The AI disconnect there would make it even better. But yeah, as far as, like, an instructional design thing, this is, like, such a great tool for anybody to check out, just to experience, to be like, oh, this is, like, where technology of tutorials is now. It's kind of mind-blowing. Tribe XR, it far overshined anything else I've seen for a tutorial in game. The fact that it not only had somebody showing you how to do it, but also went that extra level and had, like, an overlay of, "Hey, like, use your Guitar Hero line track here to know when you're supposed to press the button, idiot." Like,
yeah.
So good. I don't have much more to say about it than that.
That's very cool.
But I'm super passionate about it. And like, that's something like, it sucks because like I keep getting into all these hobbies through gaming, like VR, and now I'm about ready to get a sim racing wheel and things like that. Like, but I don't feel like sim racing could go like that, but I don't feel like my like interest in DJing is going to fade anytime soon because I'm so interested in music. Mm. And it's got me experienced with all these different artists and things like that I want to share with people and things like that. Very happy. Yeah, it
feels well aligned with you.
Yeah, totally. It also, there's a little bit like, you know, I guess I'll ask you guys, cause I don't know if you'll agree with me, but you know how like sometimes you don't really want to talk about how you're a gamer around mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
Like sure do, yep. DJing is another thing that's just like that. Like there is a bit of like, it feels like easily ridiculable, I guess is a way of like, I don't want to say I'm a DJ.
You tell people you've got a podcast.
Well, no, yes. Like the podcast is a little bit easier for me, but just saying like, oh yes, I enjoy playing video games. Oh, you're a gamer is what will come after that. Like, right. I want to say like, I enjoy playing playlists of music for people that are beat matched and they'll be like, oh, you're a DJ. It's kind of like that same thing where I don't necessarily like it, but I am super passionate about it and I will do it. But it's, I don't want to say it's embarrassing. It's just like, I feel
that
there's like
a mini stigma to it.
Yeah. Stigma is a great word for it. There, yeah. I also feel that strongly.
I think being a DJ is way cooler than being a gamer, just for reference. Yeah.
I am curious if that is a generational thing also, right? Like we still interact with a bunch of people that are around our same age group that have kind of aged up with games. And if they weren't interested in games 20 or 15 years ago, like their knowledge of it doesn't really exist. But I would assume for someone that's, you know, 15, 20 years older, like gaming is omnipresent. It's across all mediums. Like I'm just very curious if that generation is also still typecasting people as like, you're a gamer, or if it's just like Fortnite, Roblox. Like there's like Roblox is like one of those where people are like, oh yeah, my kids are learning things and going to like classes in Roblox. And I'm like, that isn't, you are a gamer, but it just might still have a different definition from people that play games.
Pamela's kids destroyed me at Risk of Rain last time we played.
I personally think that stigma is going to stick around for a long time because I think a lot of it's about the nature of fandom and gaming communities and the way that.
Yeah. And popular culture and things like that. Like, I feel like a movie will still be like, oh, he's a gamer. And they'll cut to a kid that's like, pew, 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 pew. And like pressing a bunch of random buttons on a controller or something like that. And it's similar to DJing because everybody seems to think like two things of DJing. Either they're like, oh, just like play with the records and like rick, rick, rick. And that, by the way, fucking super hard. Like anybody who mm-hmm. thinks they could just like scratch is insanely wrong. That's very difficult to do. And the other people who are like, oh, they're just like turning a bunch of knobs for no reason while they're playing music is like, no, it's not necessarily for no, like, I guess some people might do it for no reason, but like they're trying to improve how the music flows together and like change the sound spectrum for you and things like that. So it's a lot of fun, but there's also like a whole lot of stuff to overcome with it. Very difficult. Beat matching, even if you have rhythm, is not an easy thing to do. To take two songs that have nothing to do with each other and make them flow into each other is very difficult.
I mean, the societal function of mocking both of them is the representation of the disconnect from human culture, right? Human like presence. Like they do share that in common, but I think people think that the purpose of being a DJ is at least to bring other people corporeal joy, which I think puts it above gaming on the spectrum of like how withdrawn from society you become.
Yeah. But as somebody who just wants to listen to music by myself too, I don't know if I align with that DJ bringing people joy thing, because my stuff would probably bring people down.
I aim to bring people misery. That's right. It's DJ Pauly.
Yes.
What do we got next?
I could segue into my slightly DJ related game that I've been playing.
Because I started this last night, I think.
Oh, you did? Why don't you tee it up for me then?
Will, let me ask you a question. Describe the game Killer Frequency to me.
Oh, man. Killer Frequency is the sequel to the game where...
I'll give you a hint. It's related to the former.
I've got the game in my mind. Remember the game that was played literally with Rock Band tracks, but you play a car that's bouncing between the tracks?
No.
Frequency?
What?
Yeah, Amplitude?
Amplitude. That's the one. It's the sequel to Amplitude.
The sequel.
Isn't Amplitude the sequel to Frequency?
Yep. Killer Bee.
And now Killer Frequency is the sequel to Amplitude.
Yeah.
Bringing it back.
Perfect. How close was I?
You were very close. This is a schlock horror late night radio DJ operator simulator where it begins with a cop calling in and saying that she found a... No, not a cop. Yeah, a cop.
Nope. Ambulance or 911 operator.
The dispatcher calling in from the police department saying she found the sheriff shot and trying to figure out what she should do from there. And you have to man the phone lines as some crime goes down.
Yeah, you're a brand new to this town radio DJ who is a supposedly successful DJ in some big city. I can't remember if it was Chicago or
Chicago.
Chicago. But you're new to this town and it's small town. You used to be a big DJ, now you're a small DJ. So it immediately reminds me of
Gone
Pontypool,
Home.
If anybody's seen that movie. If they haven't, they should watch it, because Pontypool is Pontypool? A fucking...
That's great, not a real name.
It's absolutely a real name. That's... And the movie describes what the name means, too.
Well, Pontypool is a...
No, go ahead, Will. What Monty Python knockoff are you going to describe?
I was thinking it was a VR pool game.
Oh, I love that. It's like pointy pool, but they miss... I don't know. I don't got it. That's actually all I know, Polly, because I only played the first, hour.
It would probably be Polly Pool, like Polygon Pool.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I only probably played about the first hour as well. So you get through, and were you, pretty much my experience with the game, you start up, and it's just kind of...
So this is a visual novel.
No, it's a first person, sit at the DJ booth, play songs, and answer call-in questions. But, the game actually starts once the whistling man, the serial killer from 50 years ago, comes back and kills the sheriff, and the 911 operator is gone to try to go get help at the next town over. So the radio DJ takes over. They forward the 911 calls to the radio DJ, and all of a sudden you have to answer 911 calls. So
it rules.
So my first call was a woman who was out jogging late at night, came across the whistling man. She's hiding in her car. And she dropped her keys outside, but she's like, I don't want to go outside because he'll find me. So you have to show her how to hotwire her car. And in your DJ place, your co-host is like, hey, there's an auto crew that does the morning show or something like that. Go through their stuff and see if you can find anything. You find a guide to
Clock the Tapper Brothers
hijacking cars. And you pretty much have to what's that game? Keep Talking and No One Explodes. You have to keep talking and no one explodes this girl through hijacking her car while she's hiding. But it's pretty much you give people advice. You tell them to
there's a hook
hide or run or things like that. Yeah, exactly. That is absolutely the vibe. But the whole time you're just in your DJ studio trying to help people who are in horrible events. So it's a horror game, but it's also schlocky and fun. I just found it a lot of fun to while people are calling in these horrible things to play music at the same time and to try to throw my paper.
That's exactly,
my paper ball through the hoop over the garbage can. It's all these dire events are going on. I'm just jamming out shooting hoops. Pretty great. Very much enjoying it. Very sad that it's not in PC VR, because it is in Oculus VR, which is why I wanted to ask you, Nate, are you playing it the proper way in VR or not?
No, I'm playing it flat screen plebby. Interesting. Okay. As in only on the Oculus Store?
Yes. That as far really as VR goes. VR. It was supposed to come to be PC VR, but I think they canceled that.
Who made this?
It's Team 17 published.
The guys 17, that made the Worms?
Correct.
Worms World Party?
They're a publisher these days more than a developer, I think.
They also are the developer. It's their first virtual reality game. What?
Yep, the Worms guys. They're busy. The logical sequel to Worms.
Yeah, all right. So, Polly, you're describing like a horror game that you're essentially solving like environmental puzzles within the DJ booth. But do you ever have fear? Like, is it a scary game or is it mostly like you're just kind of like observing from audio log?
It seems like a short game and I feel like it's building up to something because like they've already kind of hinted at like there's kids who are joking around that, oh, I'm the whistling man type thing, and you like fuck around with them, but it seems like your choices could matter, and it could get to the point where the whistling man comes to the DJ place because he's obviously listening, because like you tell these kids who are pretending to, oh yeah, meet me out back of this place or something like that, and it's very possible they could die, so there's definitely like, even without you being in harm, there's the dire circumstances of you getting someone killed. So that is kind of scary. Like a girl saying like, I'm playing this off as all fun, but a girl saying like, I'm cowering in my car afraid that this man's going to kill me and you have to help me is a different take on terror. That's hasn't been done in possibly any other game that I know of, but
it's really about just keeping the tension.
Nextlander was talking about a game like this where you were, you play like a 911 help operator, but you're in a world where there's like magic and demons and shit.
Oh yeah, that's a game I really want to play. Home. What the hell is the name
of it? Sequel to
Home
the
Frequency.
It's the sequel to the guys who did the game where you're all playing in like an old MS DOS or a Windows 3.1 game. Bunch of true gamers here.
I don't know if you're talking about the same game I'm talking about now. The Home Safety Hotline is the game I'm thinking
that's
of.
That's the one.
Yeah.
That sounds great. But yeah, they're like, I've got this demon that's running around my house and it's got like three heads and you have to like, you're basically playing, what's the one where you were letting people through
papers,
the border?
Please.
Papers, please. But you have to like look through a book and be like, oh, if the demon has three heads but only two arms, then it's this kind of demon, and that one's friendly. But this other kind of three heads and four arms, that's a...
Home Safety Hotline is the closest game to this that I've seen available, and I want it, but that one just came out. That was released in January, so...
Of this year?
Yeah. Home Safety Hotline was. Killer Frequency came out last year.
Interesting. Now, I'm actually more intrigued. We had talked about this a little behind the scenes of doing this as a podcast game. Polly was trying to get us all engaged on it, but it's like, I have no idea what this is. And I'm ironically more intrigued than previously to play it. The VR option sounds dope, but
yeah,
only one of us has that available.
It is fun without VR as well. And there is one other game that it reminds me of, but it's not horror themed at all. And that is what's the game where you're a video editor for a news show, Nate?
Oh, I haven't played that yet either. I don't remember.
Not for broadcast.
Yeah,
I had to think about that for a minute, but it does seem very in line with that same thing where it's almost a Papers, Please. Like Papers, Please was so like not actual similar to what you're doing. It was much more like, I don't know, abstract in it, where these are like you're really like doing the things that you're supposed to be doing, but they also make it fun in some way. Killer Frequency with horror, not for broadcast with hilarity and things like that.
Is the soundtrack good in Killer Frequency, or are you listening to your own music?
Are those real albums?
I was just going to ask. I've only listened to like two or three of the tracks on there, but there's a selection of albums that you can pull out and play. They okay, seem
that's awesome.
Fun. They seem kind of like mock synthwave almost, but not in a bad way.
It's like schlock synthwave, which is interesting because synthwave is already kind of schlock.
Yeah, but not. It's not like terrible. It's just like not necessarily something yet that I'd be like, I need to get the soundtrack of, but it's not bad either.
I have to micro focus on that mechanic. When you're playing with mouse and keyboard, you're looking at a record crate in like 3D, and as you mouse vertically over the crate in perspective, it like flips between all the records in a way that's like ridiculously satisfying. It's a perfect sounds like it's great. I think that might do it. About time to wrap up.
How are you going to close this out, Nate?
I'm going to close this out by saying this is the end of the podcast. Thank you for joining us. Let us know how you like this new format. And
hey, let me ask you a question, listener. Why don't you go just tell somebody about us? That'd be cool, right?
I agree. Throw us a rating. Tell a friend. If you don't have friends, that's okay. You can make one up with ChatGPT.
Tell
Hit
your
the
grandma.
Subscribe button.
We're like not against subscribe. We're not ageist here.
We are a pro-grandma podcast. I'm not sure about grandpa, but we're pro-grandma.
All right, cool.
Five star.
Like, subscribe. Repost.
All right. Later,
Put
everyone.
Put us on X.
No. we're not making X a thing.
Put us on Twitter. Bye.